sectors like LIGO and Virgo that I will say a couple of words about in just a moment. So just a very brief introduction to gravitational waves. I suspect that you've already heard a number of talks on gravitational waves recently, so I won't spend much time on this. But the basic idea is that we're talking about ripples in space-time that are propagating at the speed of light and that stretch and squeeze space in directions transverse to the directions of propagation. In principle, gravitational waves actually carry a very significant amount of energy. If we're talking about a merger of a supermassive black hole binary, we might have as much as a few percent of the mass energy of the binary being emitted in the last few hours of its life. That means that temporarily this thing outshines over those few hours a galaxy which is emitting electromagnetically over its entire lifetime. Nonetheless, gravitational waves are very difficult to detect because, unfortunately, they couple very weakly with matter. But of course, it's both a challenge and an opportunity because it also means that we can see gravitational waves from very far away or very far back in time. Gravitational waves are probably best listened to. So here is the sound of a 1.4 solar mass neutron star falling into, spiraling into a 10 solar mass black hole. Keep in mind that when we're talking about these waves, this actually falls more or less into the audible frequency range. The ground-based detectors that I will be mostly focusing on today are sensitive at frequencies of between a few tens and a couple thousand hertz, but the peak sensitivity is at around 1 or 200 hertz, and that's really where these sources composed of binary neutron stars, neutron star black hole binaries, or binary black holes fall in terms of their late in spiral merger and coalescence. And so here you heard this characteristic chirp signal of an in-spiraling neutron star black hole binary. As the system is spiraling in, the frequency is going up and the amplitude of the gravitational waves is going up. So you hear this sound. And let me just play a slightly different one for you. Again, this is an animation made by a summer student working with me last summer. This next one corresponds to a binary black hole with different mass components, 14 and 50 solar masses. Now, the basic sound was probably pretty similar, right? It sounded like, again, this chirp with increasing frequency and amplitude. But the thing that hopefully you noticed was that the chirp was a little bit different, right? The frequency evolution was different. The general features have changed. Now, what this actually tells us is that it's not just a game of trying to detect one of these things. It's actually a possibility that we could take one of these observations and then go backwards, solve the inverse problem, and infer from the gravitational wave signature the parameters of the system that was actually emitting gravitational waves. And this is something that I'll discuss more during the talk. Just to mention very briefly, although, of course, we don't have direct detections of gravitational waves yet, we do have indirect observations through the measurement of Pulsar 1913 plus 16, the Hals-Taylor binary, and more recently, the double pulsar GO737, where very precise tests have confirmed that indeed the evolution of the orbits of these binary systems composed of two neutron stars follow exactly the kind of evolution you expect from the energy and angular momentum loss to gravitational wave emission. But of course, these are precise tests of relativity, but precise tests when we're still in the regime where the typical velocity is a thousandth of the speed of light. Whereas when we are talking about gravitational wave observations, we can, in principle, probe systems which are moving at a significant fraction of the speed of light. So this is going to be a very different regime. And again, something I'll return to later is the possibility of doing real tests and probes of very strong field dynamical gravity with gravitational wave observations. Just very briefly, how do we actually go about detecting these? People build interferometers. A laser beam goes in. It's split by a beam splitter. The laser light goes out to two mirrors attached to test masses, basically pendula. As the gravitational wave passes through, it alternately stretches one arm of the interferometer and squeezes the other arm, or half a cycle later, stretches this arm, squeezes this arm. That means that you see, as the light comes back to the beam splitter, that there's a phase shift between the two arms of the interferometer, and that means that you can actually detect a gravitational wave. And detectors have been built. This is a LIGO detector, one of the two LIGO detectors in the US. This is a Virgo detector in Italy. At the moment, the detectors are down for commissioning and upgrades, but will be up again in a couple of years and ready to make gravitational wave observations. And just to show you that indeed this is not a complete pipe dream, this is actually the noise spectrum of one of the LIGO detectors going from its initial science run in 2002 to a science run in 2007. And you can see that this is a plot of the noise power spectrum, the noise amplitude spectral density as a function of frequency. You can see a couple of things here. First of all, you can see that over a few years, the detectors have improved by actually two orders of magnitude and eventually reached the design sensitivity that you see as a solid black line. But you also see that, as I mentioned earlier, that we're primarily sensitive in this frequency range of a few hundred hertz, which means that really compact binaries are the most likely source for these detectors. And this is actually the first thing that I will discuss briefly, is really what are the expected rates of compact binary mergers, and therefore, what are our genuine expectations for actually seeing these sources in advanced detectors. I will then focus primarily on the topic that is probably of most interest to me over the next several years, and it's a program that I've been involved in for a number of years now and trying to make progress in different fronts of this, as I'll explain, and that is really being prepared to take gravitational wave observations that will be coming in a few years and using them to solve the inverse problem of astrophysics, to actually constrain some of the unknown astrophysical parameters that describe binary evolution, that describe single star evolution, describe supernova and supernova kicks and so on. And then finally, I will discuss a little bit about some of the possibilities that I mentioned for actually probing strong field gravity and testing general relativity with observations of gravitational waves. Okay, so on the issue of predicting the rates of binary mergers, I'm just going to go quickly through some of the mechanisms that we use to make these predictions. The probably most obvious one, of course, is to actually start with direct observations. Now, the only sources out of the group of neutron star binaries, black hole binaries, and neutron star black hole binaries, the only ones out of these that we've observed directly are binary neutron stars. There are about 10 known neutron star binaries in the galaxy, where at least one of them has been detected as a radio pulsar. In one case, JO737, both have been detected as radio pulsars. About five of them are actually merging in the next 10 billion years. Those are, of course, the ones that are of interest to us in terms of being able to predict the rates. And we can try to extrapolate. Yes, please.
So you said we've observed binary neutron stars. So how do we know that both of them are neutron stars?
Okay, so in the case of JO737, we can be quite sure because actually both have been seen as pulsars, right? In other cases, typically it's a case of having a mass measurement that is consistent with a neutron star and having the absence of an observable electromagnetic signature.
But I mean, if neutron star doesn't have any accretion into it, it doesn't have an electromagnetic signature.
Right. But I'm saying that if it were a main sequence star, for example, of 1.5 solar masses, given we're talking about things that are certainly within a kiloparsec, we would have actually been able to see that electromagnetically.
But couldn't you have like 1.4 solar mass black hole?
Absolutely. So this is, in principle, in this system, it could be, you're absolutely right, it could be 1.4 solar mass black hole. Now, okay, in general, in some sense, if we're talking about merger rates, right, it doesn't change the picture because the future evolution of the system is basically going to be the same. It's mostly evolving as two-point masses, right? So as long as it's two compact objects, we would still get the same rates. Now, there are sort of reasons to, let's say, be skeptical that you have black holes that are that low of a mass, but absolutely, it is conceivably possible, and you're absolutely right. We don't know for a fact that it's not a black hole.
Okay.
Doesn't that change the extrapolated rate estimates because you have a very different potentially very different evolutionary path to a neutron star, low mass black hole binary?
Well, it doesn't.
Think of one.
Right. So it changed. It would change the rate estimates if, for example, you are, as I will mention in a moment, I'm going to go to a discussion of population synthesis modeling, which is actually a modeling of the evolutionary scenarios, right? And if, for example, we use observations as constraints on the modeling, then absolutely it changes the picture. And this is something that certainly we have done. We don't want to just model in the dark. We have these observations, we use them as constraints. It could be that the constraints are being misapplied. You're right. But if we are very naive about this and just say, look, we are just taking these known systems, we know how these systems will evolve into the future, and then we just know something about the selection effects, then if anything, if these are neutron star black hole binaries, and neutron star black hole binaries with these mass ranges of 1.4, 1.4 solar masses are quite common, then in fact, if anything, we would actually increase the rates a bit, because certainly the black hole would not be seen as a pulsar, so that means that we sort of have a selection bias against seeing at least one of the two components. So that means given what we're seeing and given the selection effects we put in, we would actually be likely to see a few more of these systems, right? So if anything, it would be kind of favorable to us for the overall merger rates. Now, of course, selection effects that I just mentioned are quite important. And of course, one of the concerns here is actually knowing the luminosity distribution of pulsars, assuming that these are really binary neutron stars. And so that's certainly a potential concern. As well as, of course, the small number statistics. And so this is leading to a significant amount of uncertainty in terms of the extrapolation from these few sources. Another way of trying to get at the rates, and of course, because of the, all of these come with various uncertainties, which is why we don't want to just rely on one particular option. We want to consider different ways of estimating the rates of binaries. But another way is to look at short gamma ray bursts. Now, we expect that short gamma ray bursts, although this is not proven, come from binary mergers, specifically neutron star binary mergers or possibly neutron star black hole binaries. One of the big uncertainties is the beaming fraction of short gamma ray bursts. So if short gamma ray bursts are very significantly beamed, that means that, of course, the few that we see are only a small sample of the entire population. There must be a lot more out there. If the beams are broader, then we're seeing a bigger fraction of all of the short gamma ray bursts that, and therefore merging systems that actually happen. Of course, another uncertainty here is whether, in fact, all merging binaries, merging neutron star binaries, for example, would create a short gamma ray burst. But in principle, this is kind of exciting because whereas the binary neutron stars are only seen in the galaxy, and even then in a small region of the galaxy, the short gamma ray bursts are probes all the way out to a redshift of order 2. And so that means that we actually are probing the binary merger rate at fairly large scales. So it's a promising venue to explore. And the rates so far seem to be, at least within their uncertainties, quite consistent between these two methods. Another method that I'm going to talk about for a little bit more. Oh, yes, please.
What is provenance?
So what I mean by this is that we're actually not entirely certain whether these things actually come from binary neutron star systems or neutron star black hole systems, or because there is no, unlike long gamma ray bursts where there's a very firm association with core collapse supernova, for short gamma ray bursts, there is no unambiguous association with compact binary mergers. In fact, that's one of the things that LIGO might be able to do. LIGO might, gravitational wave observations might be able to really, for the first time, give us confidence that compact binary mergers and short gamma ray bursts really are the same thing, or rather that short gamma ray bursts come from these compact binary mergers. For example, if we're actually fortunate enough to see in coincidence with Swift or Fermi a short gamma ray burst, and with LIGO and Virgo a signature from a merger of two neutron stars coming at the same time from the same region of the sky, I think that would actually answer this question about the provenance of these systems once and for all. So moving on to population synthesis, this is sort of returning to the point that Avery made earlier. Of course, both of these methods I discussed previously are based on observations. And for example, observations can tell us nothing about binary black holes. It's very hard to electromagnetically observe binary black holes. there have been a couple of hints that maybe you might be able to see a black hole binary through microlensing, but it's a really difficult thing to do and not at all clear. So one of the approaches to doing this, of course, is population synthesis. The basic idea is the following. We have some understanding, actually, astrophysically, of how these binaries form. That there must be two massive stars that are formed in an isolated binary. There's mass transfer from one of the objects to another one. There's a supernova. There is an expansion of the secondary star. Most likely, there's a common envelope phase where the core of the secondary and the primary that has already turned into a compact object are actually inside a common hydrogen envelope. This hydrogen envelope is expelled, carrying away with it a significant amount of energy that allows the binary to shrink. That shrinking of the binary is very important because otherwise you end up with two compact objects that are so far apart that they will take more than a Hubble time to merge through gravitational wave emission. And finally, you have a second supernova. You hope the second supernova does not disrupt the binary because if the kick is too large, you might disrupt the binary altogether. And if everything goes according to plan, you actually end up with a compact binary, be it a binary interstar or a binary black hole or an interstar black hole binary. Now, as you may have guessed from this very... Yes, please.
How are you sharing these binary stars?
I'm sorry?
How are you sharing the binary stars? I mean, what's the mechanism to sharing this?
Okay, so there are a few things that are going on. First of all, of course, the mass transfer can, in principle, change the configuration of the binary, but also the most likely mechanism is believed to be actually the emission of energy through the expulsion of the common envelope. The problem is the exact physics of this are actually extremely poorly known. This is one of the big problems in this field. People actually don't know, for example, what fraction of the how efficient this mechanism is, what fraction of the binary's orbital energy is actually necessary to power the expulsion of the envelope. So it's reasonably clear that the envelope does get expelled. But how exactly this happens is still very much of a mystery, and that's actually one of the things that, as I'll mention, we can hope to probe with these kinds of observations. As I said, as you may have guessed from this, there are a number of poorly constrained parameters here. Supernova kicks, for example, stellar winds, mass transfer efficiency, common envelope physics. Also, as was discovered recently, this is a paper that we had written with some Polish collaborators last year. There are issues relating to metallicity variations, even in the local universe, which actually have a pretty significant impact, as it turns out, on binary evolution. There are issues in exactly what is the supernova mechanism and the amount of fallback, which determines, for example, what will be the mass of the black holes, and also on what the kicks of the black holes will be. There are concerns about what happens if the donor is going through the Hertzsprung gap, basically has not yet had a clear core envelope separation. When you enter a common envelope phase, maybe the separation is not yet sufficiently clean. You basically end up with a sort of wet merger during the common envelope instead of really being able to expel the envelope and have a compact core and a compact companion, an interstar black hole, that eventually can actually generate a proper compact binary merger. So there are lots of uncertainties here. And just to sort of give you a hint of how bad the uncertainties are, here are a number of models. I've intentionally not labeled the models. So you know, it's these various parameters that I discussed that are being changed from model to model. But what I'm showing here are typical rates in units per Milky Way galaxy per million years. And you can see that you end up, you know, for binary interstars, interstar black hole binaries, binary black holes, with a very large range of rates, a couple of orders of magnitude of uncertainty. Now, of course, some of these models are probably less likely than others, but at least it gives you a hint of how little we actually know about these processes, how uncertain some of these parameters are. Now, of course, this is sort of the pessimistic way of looking at it. The optimistic way of looking at it is, great, if we knew everything, LIGO would be kind of boring. What's the point of building this thing if we can predict exactly what it's going to see? Then it's not going to tell us anything. It's the fact that these things have such a large variability that actually tells us, look, by making a measurement, we can figure out which of these models is the right one. We can actually figure out exactly what is the supernova mechanism or exactly what is the common envelope physics. Of course, we cannot do it exactly. Of course, there are many parameters coupled in. But we can try to play this game. And just to give you another sort of little preview, and I'll return to this slide later, one of the ways to play this game is not just with the rates, of course, but also with the parameters of the systems. So here, again, don't worry about what the submodel A and submodel B are. But just to, again, from the same paper, there are plots of the distributions of chirp masses. Chirp mass is a particular combination of the two masses, which is particularly well measured from gravitational wave observations. So you have in blue the binary neutron star chirp masses, in red the black hole neutron star chirp masses, and green, which I hope you can still see, the black hole chirp masses. And you can see that there's quite a bit of variation between different models, right? Over here, for example, you have a rather narrow range of chirp masses for binary black holes. Over here, you have an extremely broad range of chirp masses for binary black holes, right? Please.
So this would be the observed number or the actual number?
This is the rate of, sorry, I have to be careful. So this is a number that would be predicted to be merging in a galaxy like the Milky Way, but in this case, sort of scaled to some arbitrary units. So the actual observations would typically favor binary black holes over binary neutron stars because the binary black holes have a stronger gravitational wave signature, so you can see them to a greater distance.
So this thing, the observed one, would be heavier towards the higher masses, like have to weigh those up and weigh the other.
Absolutely, ones. Absolutely. Right, and so you actually are bringing up a very important point that if we want to compare, in the end, ultimately observations against predictions, we have to be very careful about accounting for selection effects from gravitational wave observations. Now, the argument I'm going to make is that in gravitational wave observations, we actually understand selection effects quite well, probably better than we typically do for most electromagnetic observations. And so in some sense, we ought to be able to decouple that parameter and deconvolve the observational selection effects. But of course, it will require some extra work. You're absolutely right. OK, so in general, as I said, this population synthesis is nice. It applies to all binary types. The difficulty, of course, is there are many poorly known input parameters. The fun is we might be able to constrain those. Now, based on these various attempts to predict the rates of binary mergers, we've put together a paper in the Leica collaboration, of which I was the corresponding author, which made a prediction for the typical merger rate. So we sort of decided to be very conservative, quote both the statistical and systematic uncertainties, and therefore put in very wide ranges. And you see here the rates. These are rates per million years per Milky Way-like galaxy. And then, of course, we can scale to the observational volume of our detectors. I'll do that in a moment. But you can see that here I'm talking about possibly as many as 3 orders of magnitude of uncertainty between the very lowest but still plausible pessimistic rates and the highest plausible optimistic rates. So for example, for binary neutron stars, we're talking about anywhere between 1 to 1,000 mergers per million years in a galaxy like ours. Now, just to sort of give you a sense of where this all fits in, if we compare this with the best upper limits currently existing from gravitational wave observations, so we're talking about the last science run of the LIGO and Virgo detectors before they went offline for upgrades to their advanced versions, we see that the upper limit was somewhere in the order of 1 times 10 to the minus 4 for in units of per megaparsec cubed per year for binary neutron star systems. Meanwhile, if I were to convert these rates and multiply them by the sensitivity of the late stage initial detectors and therefore figure out what is the rate that this corresponds to, I would end up with something like a rate of 10 to the minus 5 per cubic megaparsec per year. In other words, the predicted plausible optimistic rate is still about a factor of 10 lower than the best existing upper limit, right? Another way of saying this is We didn't detect anything with initial detectors. Honestly, we probably shouldn't have expected to detect anything unless we got incredibly lucky. Conversely, the fact that we didn't see anything hasn't actually really constrained our astrophysics very much. Now, I will say in a moment that this is not the case for advanced detectors. There, we really do expect to make detections. First, let me just mention one more possible way of, yes, please.
So why does this have units of per megaparsec cube? Because, I mean, you're talking about everything that LIGO would see. So.
Sorry, I think I misspoke when I was talking about multiplying by the sensitivity volume here. We really are just, the only conversion from here to here is just looking at the density of Milky Way like galaxies in space. Right. Sorry, I you're absolutely right.
These are actual rates.
Yeah, these are actual rates. So these are actual constraints on actual rates. So already we've taken the sensitivity into account when placing these constraints. Okay, so just to mention one more approach to looking at typical rate predictions, we can actually try to evolve observed systems forward, right? We can take observed X-ray binaries, either black hole X-ray binaries or neutron star X-ray binaries, and ask, okay, let's combine these observations with the population synthesis modeling. But instead of starting with some arbitrary population of massive stars, we're actually going to start with the observed conditions that these particular binaries are in. And so there's been a fair amount of work on this, including some work that I've been involved in, for example, on modeling the future evolution of Cygnus X3. There are, of course, many uncertainties, both on the observational side, because in some cases, we don't actually know observationally exactly what the masses are, especially what the mass of the companion is. There are also uncertainties about the exact amount of mass loss rate. For example, for some of the high mass X-ray binaries, we're talking about Wolf-Rayet stars in orbit around a black hole. The mass loss rate for Wolf-Rayet stars is extremely high, but it's not very precisely quantified at present. So it can make a big difference how much mass actually gets lost before you're going to form a black hole. Of course, the amount of fallback is quite important, but in principle, again, you can play these games and you find that for some of these systems, you actually predict that they are quite likely to form either black hole, neutron star, black hole binaries at non-negligible rates, given that we've detected these systems in the very local universe. So therefore, the rates must be significant, especially since some of these systems are only visible for a very short fraction of their lifetime. For example, these high mass X-ray binaries, Wolf-Rayet stars, are probably only visible as such for about 1 million years. So having played all of these games, we can now actually ask, where are we going to go with advanced detectors? Now, advanced detectors are basically about a factor of 10 more sensitive than initial detectors over a broad band. They also have significantly improved low frequency sensitivity, which is very important for high mass sources. Typical frequencies scale as 1 over the mass. And so that means we can now take the rates that I had written down, the merger rates I had written down on previous slides, and convolve them with the sensitivity of these advanced detectors to actually ask, in the full configuration of advanced detectors, which probably won't happen immediately. The detectors turn on in 2015, but we won't reach full sensitivity until maybe 2018, 2019, 2020, depending on which experimentalists you talk to. But you probably expect the following actual rates of detection. So these are rates of detections per year. You expect anywhere from, on the very pessimistic side, one detection every couple of years. And notice, by the way, that these numbers are actually quite similar for the different sources. This is exactly addressing your question that even though binary black holes are much more rare, they're seen much further, all the way to possibly hundreds of detections per year. Now, the end limits are pretty, conservative. So I don't necessarily expect either of these numbers. I actually think that that numbers of a few per year to maybe a few tenths per year are much more plausible. But also the fact that we are seeing really for all these different source types and with so many different scenarios for actually trying to predict these rates, we're seeing these significant rates makes me personally quite confident that really we are talking about making multiple detections by the end of this decade. Now, whether multiple means few tens, few hundred, of course, remains to be seen. Just very briefly, let me mention one more mechanism actually for forming these binaries, and that is dynamical formation of binaries in dense stellar environments, right? So far, we've talked about isolated binaries. You can also form binaries dynamically if you're in a regime, for example, in a globular cluster or in a nuclear cluster at the center of a galaxy where you have significant interactions between systems. So you might have a sort of soup of black holes flying around. In some cases, three-body interactions can extract enough energy from a binary to gradually harden it over time and get it to merge. In some cases, you might even directly have so much gravitational energy emitted during the very first periapsis passage that you basically have a direct capture scenario. Two black holes are flying by each other at periapsis, emit enough energy that they go from a hyperbolic orbit to a very elliptical, very eccentric but elliptical orbit, and then they merge in a time scale of hours. Again, there are a number of studies that have looked at this, and the typical predictions are, once again, that you may see a few tens of events from these dense stellar environments with advanced gravitational wave detectors. One topic that I'm particularly interested in is intermediate mass black holes, something that I've worked a fair amount on. And of course, we don't know that intermediate mass black holes exist at all, right? We're talking here about black holes with masses of, let's say, a few hundred solar masses. These are very difficult to detect electromagnetically. In fact, this is actually what makes it so exciting. Gravitational wave observations might be one of the few ways, perhaps the only way, we can unambiguously say, look, we do have a population of these 100, 200, 300 solar mass black holes living, let's say, in the centers of globular clusters. But there is reasonable growing evidence that there is this population in between the stellar mass black hole population and the supermassive black hole population. There are multiple formation scenarios that have been proposed for these. And with LIGO, you could actually observe either mergers of intermediate mass black hole binaries or in spirals of stellar mass compact objects into intermediate mass black holes. Okay, so what do you do with all of these rates? Well, of course, you first argue to funding agencies that this is a good reason to fund advanced detectors. But that's sort of been done already. Advanced detectors are fully funded. They are going online soon. So that, on that, we can say mission accomplished. The next thing you can try to do is to say, how should you actually tune your detectors and tune your searches, right? There are different configurations for detectors. You can have broadband configurations, narrowband configurations, configurations that are more sensitive at low frequencies or more sensitive at high frequencies. You can play this game of tuning your detectors and also prioritizing your different searches based on what it is that you expect to see. And so, of course, for this, again, rate predictions are important. But to be honest, from my point of view, the really exciting bit is not this, because we've already made the rate predictions. We're already building the detectors. Now really comes the fun part of doing science with them. And so now let me move on to the bit about actually doing science with these detections. So at the very lowest order, you might say, OK, let's suppose that we don't actually detect anything, at least not immediately. In 2015, detectors go on. Initially, they have some sensitivity that's higher than perhaps early detectors, but initial detectors, but not at the full sensitivity of advanced detectors yet. There's going to be some commissioning to get us there. So initially, we just place upper limits, but they're more interesting upper limits than any we've had in the past. They start eating into the allowed space of rates. Already, you can do a little bit with this. So for example, if this is your prediction for merger rates that comes about from, let's say, assuming some very flat priors on the various parameters, uncertain astrophysical parameters I talked about before, supernova kicks, fallback, mass transfer, common envelope, etc. And then you decide, OK, I'm going to just arbitrarily assume that I put an upper limit right here through the rates. So all of the models that yielded these rates over here have been ruled out. That means that now if I plot some particular parameter, this parameter is some dimensionless parameter describing the stellar wind strength in massive stars. the exact value doesn't matter. I just wanted to notice sort of the shape of it, right? It goes from basically being more or less flat, right? This blue line, this is before we put in any constraints. So basically we're saying that, look, at the moment this parameter is not well constrained from existing astrophysical observations. Now it goes to having this red shape, right, which is clearly peaked at, in this case, higher values of this parameter, right? So what basically I'm saying here is, look, because I've ruled out all of these models with high rates typically corresponded to choices where this particular parameter had low values. Those are now ruled out. That means I'm now favoring higher values of this parameter, right? So this is the kind of, naively, this is the kind of game that we can play even with upper limits. Of course, you know, if we're only in the business of going for upper limits, that's not very exciting. And as I told you before, I think we will have observations. And so then we can do a lot more than just playing with rates. Because we can actually now look at the distributions of the parameters, right? We can actually say, does the distribution of parameters, the measured masses, the measured spins, the measured distances and distributions of space, do these things actually tell us something about the astrophysical evolution scenarios? So remember this picture that shows you that there is quite a bit of fluctuation depending on what you have assumed about these the input physics and input astrophysics into these catalogs of models. We can actually try to figure out which one of these is right. Now, doing so requires us to do very accurate parameter estimation on individual sources. That's not so easy to do. I played two sounds for you at the very beginning of this talk. The sounds corresponded to a binary, or a neutron star black hole, binary black hole. You heard the sounds were different, and so you can imagine, well, we can tell apart these systems. But in practice, this is actually quite a challenging problem because we have a very large high-dimensional parameter space, 9 parameters for systems with non-spinning components, 15 if the components are spinning. We have to coherently analyze data streams from multiple detectors. We have to make use of a priori information. We do have some a priori knowledge that we want to feed into this. We have the possibility that there are degeneracies. For example, here is actual inference on a potential signal. This is the location of the source in the sky, and you can see that there are 2 different peaks here. Turns out there's a bit of a symmetry across the reflection symmetry across the plane of the detectors. And of course, in the end, we don't want to just know the best fit values of the parameters. We want to know also the uncertainty on those best fit values. So all of this tells us that the solution ought to be to do Bayesian inference, and it also ought to be to use some sort of stochastic techniques to explore this very high dimensional parameter space. Now, there's been a lot of work that my collaborators and I have done on this, and I'm not going to discuss this work in detail or bore you with the technical challenges of things like, forgive me, Markov chain Monte Carlo or nested sampling or multi-nest and all of the fun bells and whistles that you can add to this. That's really actually quite an exciting topic and probably deserves a separate talk, but won't bore you with this today. I just want to show you a little animation of how the Markov chain Monte Carlo stochastically explores the parameter space. So here you see projection. This is actually a 9-dimensional search, but there are 2 chains that correspond to 2 different masses, one shown in red, one shown in blue. I'm just projecting things into a 2-dimensional mass parameter space. And you can see over here that I'm gradually building up a posterior probability density function in this 2-dimensional parameter space. By the way, this banana shape that you're seeing is actually quite typical. Remember I said that there's one parameter, the chirp mass, that you can measure very well. Another parameter, the mass ratio, you cannot measure so well. That's what you're seeing here. The chirp mass basically goes this way. The mass ratio goes this way. And so we have this partial degeneracy in the component mass space. Should be familiar to electromagnetic observers as well. For example, measuring the mass function of binaries has some degeneracy between masses and the inclination angle of the binary. And by playing this game, we can actually make measurements in the entire 15-dimensional parameter space. So here is actually a result from one of our earlier papers from a few years ago showing the posteriors on the individual variables. Some, like the chirp mass, we measure very well to 1% accuracy. sum, like let's say the spin of the secondary in this case, you can see this is essentially flat, which was actually be our prior on the magnitude of the spin of the secondary, so we haven't been able to measure it very well at all. As I said, won't talk to you about the technical details today. I just want to show one particularly nice recent result, and the reason I want to highlight this one is that actually it was partly done here at Perimeter Institute. My graduate student, Rory Smith, was visiting Chad on a graduate student fellowship last year, and Rory, who has just successfully defended, is about to move on to Caltech as a postdoc, has done this very nice work where we basically looked at ways to speed up this parameter estimation process, which is quite computationally intensive. The first idea was to use interpolation over waveforms, basically consider waveforms corresponding to different parameters, and instead of recalculating the waveform every time, interpolate once you've computed a sufficient number of waveforms. And it turns out you can do this reasonably accurately and get significant gains in computational efficiency. But the really nice idea was to directly interpolate the likelihoods, in other words, directly interpolate the quality of the fit between the data and the presumed waveform model. And it turns out that this can actually be done to a very good accuracy, sub-percent accuracy, and this should potentially allow us to speed up parameter estimation, which is quite computationally intensive, by easily a factor of 100 or 1,000. So now that we have actually been able to do accurate parameter estimation, we can try to combine information from multiple detections to while accounting for the selection effects that have been mentioned previously. So let me ask you a little question. Let's see if people are still awake. We have several observations. Let's say we're trying to measure, in some dimensionless units, the chirp mass of a system. We have three different observations, and each observation returns some somewhat uncertain measurement of the chirp mass. One observation, second observation, third observation. Now, these are not the same system. These are different systems, of course. We want to know what is the distribution of chirp masses in the population as a whole. What do? Do we add them? Do we multiply them? Do we do something else to them? Any guesses?
Multiply.
Turns out you don't necessarily quite want to multiply because, for example, imagine you have the following situation, right? Imagine you have this thing that is basically, you know, constrained completely to be below 0.5. And over here, you have something that's completely constrained to be above 0.5. You multiply them, you get a zero, right? But that actually doesn't tell you that the overall distribution is zero. It just says that maybe the overall distribution is actually flat. You know, in one case, you saw something that had a low chirp mass, and in the other case, you saw something that had a high chirp mass, for example. It actually does turn out to be something else. I won't have time to explain what the something else is. There's a link to a paper over there.
One peaks below 0.51, the other peaks above and a zero otherwise, that means there's, the data is inconsistent, so I'm not...
Oh, sorry, so I'm not referring to... So we are measuring the chirp mass for different systems, right? You might have a situation where you indeed have a wide distribution of chirp mass parameters overall in your universe. What I really want to know is what is the distribution of chirp masses for all binaries taken together.
So you're saying that you have these error distributions, and then you want to get the distribution of chirp masses.
Exactly. So these are measurements. This is what I get from binary 1. This is what I get from binary 2. This is what I get from binary 3. And now I want to know, you know, the whole population, what is its distribution.
So in other words, backing out population distributions of noisily measured data.
Absolutely. Exactly. And I mean, this is sort of one of the nice things about these, you know, some of the techniques that we've been working on here. Actually, it turns out that many of these techniques are applicable far beyond just gravitational wave astrophysics. And in fact, already I've applied some of the techniques that I and my collaborators have developed in this context to very different studies. So, for example, Avery and I were just discussing before this talk started some work that I was doing with Duncan Lorimer, a radio pulsar observer, about looking at his data and using similar statistical techniques to make inference on properties of radio pulsars. We've done some studies that allow us to distinguish foreground and background distributions in general in any kind of physical or astronomical system, and for example, have applied it to things like observations of globular clusters with a background of galactic field stars, where you try to somehow simultaneously infer properties of both the cluster and the field star population without being able to identify for any given star whether the star belongs to the cluster or the field, because you just have a single photograph showing you, you know, a blobby collection of stars, but a whole bunch of stars spread over the entire field of the photograph. So there's lots of crosstalk and lots of opportunity for exchange between these techniques and essentially any kind of statistical approaches in physics or astronomy. And of course, the next step is that once you have extrapolated some sort of population information from your detections, from your observations, you want to compare it against a catalog of simulations based on different assumed astrophysical parameters. You want to therefore have a pipeline that allows you to compare your observations with the catalogs. Of course, you also want to worry a little bit, what if my population synthesis just isn't quite right? What if there's some physics that I missed out on? I don't want to just blindly compare against my models. So one thing I want to do is I want to actually over-constrain my models. I want to get into the regime where I don't just say, this model is better than this model. I want to say, hey, look, all of my models are potentially ruled out because they have enough observations that none of them fit the data. Actually, none of them fit the models. Actually, I prefer to be in that situation because that would almost give me confidence that, you know, really we are doing genuine science instead of just tweaking parameters in a regime where we have so many free parameters we can accommodate anything, right? So we want to know how many detections will actually be required. And this is, for example, something we're trying to do at the moment, but I don't have an answer right now, just some guesses about how many observations will actually be necessary to make these kinds of constraints. But also, you might say, okay, well, what if we just step aside for a moment and don't just try to make comparisons against population synthesis models? Can we do some model-independent or weakly model-dependent comparisons? I think the answer is actually yes. So let me just give you a couple of examples. For example, a fairly generic feature of these population synthesis models suggests that there is evidence for a mass gap. A gap between the most massive neutron stars, which actually the highest known neutron star masses today are about 2 solar masses. The highest predicted possible neutron star masses are about 3 solar masses. And the lowest mass black holes. Again, at least from observations of X-ray binaries, black hole X-ray binaries, several groups, including a group of my collaborators and myself, concluded that the black hole X-ray binary observations are consistent with a low mass cutoff of about 5 solar masses. So in principle, there's already some evidence there for a mass gap, but there is some uncertainty because there could be some selection effects that could be quite important there. And so one can actually go and look for the evidence of this mass gap. And these are basically the gaps you're seeing over here between the binary neutron star, black hole neutron star, and binary black hole population plotted on a plot showing the Chirp mass on this axis and the symmetric mass ratio on this axis. So at 0.25, these are actually equal mass systems. This is actually something we can directly probe, right? So this is fairly weakly model dependent. And we can see, is there really evidence for the mass gap? And if there is really evidence for a mass gap, that actually turns out to tell us something about the supernova mechanism, for example, and the amount of fallback that we expect from during the collapse, core collapse of a massive star. Let me give you one more example. I mentioned earlier something about the possibility of there being dynamical populations of black holes that might be formed in globular clusters or other dense stellar environments. Could we tell apart binary black holes that form through this isolated binary evolution scenario from binary black holes that are formed dynamically? One telltale sign might be eccentricity. It's very hard to get an eccentric system if it's an isolated binary. It evolves very gradually, and eccentricity is damped out by gravitational wave emission. But another possibility, for example, might be to measure spin alignments, because you might very crudely expect that if you have a situation where you have significant amounts of mass transfer going on in during the history of the system, you might preferentially tend to align the spins, and so isolated binaries might preferentially have their spins aligned, whereas for dynamically formed binaries, you expect a basically isotropic distribution of spins. An idea that I just had very recently was the possibility of measuring time delays by observing the dependence of the merger rate and redshift. If I look at the star formation rate, and really I only care about the star formation rate at low redshift basically because we're only sensitive to low redshifts anyway, it actually has a pretty steep slope, steep enough that between the range of LIGO to binary black holes, which is about a redshift of 0.3 or 0.4, and the redshift 0, there's about a factor of 2 difference in the star formation rate. If I expect that their time delays are very short, right, then the merger rate should just follow the star formation rate. But if I expect significant time delays between mergers, between star formation and merger, which again is some tells me something about the actual binary evolution astrophysics, then I can expect that the slope of the merger rate will actually change, and in the case of extreme time delays, it can actually be completely inverted from the slope, which actually says that there's more star formation at higher redshifts, to this inverse slope, whereby you would actually have a higher merger rate at redshift 0 than at a redshift of 0.3 or 0.4. This is something we can potentially test. We can potentially play around with binary kick velocities from gravitational waves. So for example, this is a plot from a paper by Luke Kelly et al. Luke is a very nice now graduate student at the time. He was still an undergrad when he that I was working with when he wrote this AbJ letter, where he basically looked at the models of dark matter evolution and looked at possible kicks that compact binaries, say neutron star binaries, might receive as a result of supernova. And if you have a sufficiently low mass halo or low mass galaxy, then that kick can actually be enough to eject the binary from the galaxy. In fact, we do see something like this with observations of short gamma ray bursts. A significant fraction of them seem to be outside of the central regions of their host galaxy, which suggests that there may have been a kick that took place. In fact, the kicks might be significant enough that either through by looking at populations of short gamma ray bursts, or even perhaps by looking at gravitational wave observations, you might be able to see signatures of greater isotropy of sources in the sky relative to the expected distributions of galaxies in dark matter if the kicks are sufficiently large. You can even do some cosmology with gravitational waves, either with electromagnetic counterparts or even without them. Now, I should be fair, the cosmology you're going to do is not quite as exciting as the kind of cosmology that you can do with type 1a supernova. You won't be able to measure the Hubble constant as accurately. But on the other hand, it has a completely different set of systematics. Gravitational waves are standard sirens, meaning it's very difficult to measure the redshift, but it's very easy to directly measure the distance. Whereas, of course, for other systems, for electromagnetic systems, you typically get the redshift easily, don't know the distance very well. And so this means that it's a different set of systematics, different set of calibration errors, so it's a very nice complementary way to explore cosmology, and again, something that we've played around with. I'm not going to talk about electromagnetic counterparts for lack of time, but this is potentially, again, an exciting prospect of actually seeing electromagnetic counterparts jointly with binary mergers. Let me just mention one possible exciting source in the 2 minutes I might have left. And this is extreme mass ratio in spirals that you might be able to observe with missions like LISA, which is a planned space-borne gravitational wave antenna. Here is what an extreme mass ratio in spiral might look like. This is a movie courtesy of Steve Drasko. So you have here a small compact object, a neutron star or a stellar mass black hole, spiraling into a supermassive black hole of the kind you might expect in the center of a galaxy. Hooray. Now somehow the central black hole has grown by a huge amount in this movie, despite the fact that it only swallowed about 1/1,000,000th of its mass. But the basic idea here is actually very simple. So I was a postdoc in Chicago at Northwestern at the time I was working on this. So imagine that here I am as a little guy traveling around Chicago, visiting it for the first time, seeing around me all these beautiful buildings and taking pictures of it. Kind of in the same way that a small object spiraling into a massive black hole is essentially acting as a probe of the space-time of this massive black hole. Now, by taking all of these pictures, I'm being a faithful journalist. I'm so small and so irrelevant relative to the landscape of Chicago or relative to the massive black hole space-time that I'm not really perturbing it in any significant way. I'm really just reporting on what it is that I'm seeing. That allows me to really act as an excellent probe of the background space-time. And one of the exciting things it allows me to do, for example, is to test the no-hair theorem. Now, the no-hair theorem, of course, says that if you are an eminent relativist like Kip Thorne, then after a while, if you spend too much time working on relativity, you tend to lose your hair. Okay, that's not quite right. The no-hair theorem should actually be about Ron Kerr. The problem is that, well, not a problem for Ron Kerr, perhaps, but the difficulty is that Roy still has all of his hair intact, so therefore, you know, the picture isn't quite as good. But the basic idea is that if your space-time is stationary, vacuum, asymptotically flat, the singularity is fully enclosed by an event horizon, and there are no closed time-like curves outside of this event horizon, then the space-time is described by a Kerr metric. In other words, we expect all of our astrophysical black holes to be described by a Kerr metric. Does that really have to be the case? Well, no, not necessarily. You can certainly solve Einstein's equations in vacuum, get an exact solution, and have a naked singularity, where there is no event horizon or incomplete event horizon, or where there are closed time-like curves outside of the event horizon. It doesn't actually violate GR in any way. Now, it might make you a little bit uncomfortable, but it would be kind of interesting to see whether there is actually evidence for the fact that the massive black holes we think live in the centers of galaxies are really Kerr black holes. And it turns out we do have some smoking guns for doing this. And the smoking gun actually comes about from something that was discovered a few years ago, and something that we explored in particular in relation to one particular metric family in a paper with Jonathan Gehr a few years ago, was the possibility that you might lose one of your isolated integrals. For a geodesic around a Kerr black hole, it turns out you have a full set of isolating integrals of motion. That means your motion is completely irregular. Turns out that one of those isolating integrals, what's called the Carter constant, actually disappears in some configurations where you have a bump on your black hole. In other words, where your black hole is not a perfect Kerr black hole. And in that case, you might actually have chaos. You might actually see evidence by, for example, plotting Poincaré maps of full-blown chaos. So for example, here is a picture where a Poincaré map shows a perfectly regular behavior. Here it is showing full-blown chaos. You can also see this if you just take a Fourier decomposition of your waveform or of your orbit. Again, you see here is a perfectly regular looking orbit, and it clearly has just harmonics of three fundamental frequencies, the radial epicyclic frequency, vertical epicyclic frequency, and azimuthal frequency. Here is an orbit that is fully chaotic, doesn't have these clear representative frequencies. This is potentially a smoking gun for the presence of chaos, and therefore for the fact that this is not a standard Kerr black hole. This actually has some very exciting and unexpected features. So I'm not going to discuss this in more detail other than to point out that in principle, this is the kind of measurement you can make certainly quite accurately with LISA, extreme mass ratio in spirals, but also possibly with some non-trivial accuracy, even with intermediate mass ratio in spirals that might be observable by advanced LIGO, where a stellar mass compact object is falling into an intermediate mass black hole. And let me just conclude here. So I'm going to flash up the conclusion slide, but just to say that from my point of view, this is really a very exciting era where we are on the verge of doing some very innovative astrophysics and probes of general relativity, strong field gravity with gravitational wave observations. But there's still quite a bit of work to be done, both on the technical front and on the analytical and modeling front to really be put ourselves into a position where we can take full advantage of the data. And there's some potential here for some very interesting research, as well as, I think, some collaborative research with many of the people in this room. So thank you.
So I think we have a little bit of time for questions. We'll go down to lunch with Ilya and if you, right afterward. And if you'd like to join us, please come. Any questions?
You said you had a guess at how many observations of Mercury you would need to have in order to over-constrain current population synthesis models, but you didn't say what the guess was.
My personal guess is actually it's going to be, at present, if you allow absolutely the full spectrum, it's going to be quite large to over-constrain all models unless you actually, it depends a little bit on exactly what kinds of observations you see, right? There can be situations where a single observation can already tell you something very funny is going on. For example, the current models actually don't predict components in the 3 solar mass range. They really do show that there is evidence for a mass gap, right? They're consistent with the mass gap. You see a single component in the 3 solar mass range, something weird is happening. If you see, for example, a single neutron star in the 2.5 solar mass range, and you observe this neutron star because you actually see some tidal effects in the latent spiral, right? So a neutron star won't behave exactly like a point particle the way a black hole would, and you might be sensitive to this if you have sufficient high frequency sensitivity in your detectors. Again, 2.5 solar mass neutron star is something that is not anticipated in the current models. So again, that alone would already rule some things out. So sometimes, you know, single observations can be quite exciting. But in general, if, for example, you're just seeing lots of neutron star binaries, and they are, you know, pretty much kind of run-of-the-mill neutron star binaries, you know, the kinds of things we sort of expect, you know, 1.4 plus 1.4 solar mass systems, right? Then you may need as many as several hundred observations in that case to really see that something is wrong if the deviation is sufficiently small from the existing model. So it's sort of a non-trivial question, right? It depends on sort of how different is the universe from your existing models.
Up to what distance you expect by LIGO, ICANN's LIGO, you expect to see this gravitational wave signals?
So it depends a little bit on the sources. If we're talking about binary neutron stars, we're only sensitive to about 400, 500 megaparsecs at full sensitivity. We're talking about stellar mass black hole binaries, let's say reasonably low mass, let's say 10 solar masses plus 10 solar masses. It's a bit over 2 gigaparsecs. If we're talking about binaries of intermediate mass black holes, you know, 100 plus 100 solar mass black hole binaries, you're sensitive to a redshift of 2. So it really depends quite a bit on the source type.
So I don't know if there is a signal from the black hole binary emerging, I mean, in the radio or visual wavelength.
People have conjectured that there might be things there. Certainly astronomers are still, that I've spoken to, are still very eager, for example, to get pointers from LIGO. If we do detect or think we've detected a black hole binary merger, they would still be quite keen on looking. But most, I have not seen sort of anything that is truly convincing in terms of a signal from a stellar mass black hole binary merger that would be electromagnetic. There's just most likely there's not enough matter around to really generate any sort of a convincing signature.
Another question on the mass gap. Since the event rates are different for the different types of binaries, how many detections can you estimate what we need in order to nail down what exactly the mass gap looks like, or if there is a mass gap?
So it depends in part on how well, you can also measure the parameters, right? Because the problem is that, you know, if I go back for a moment to my slide over here, right? The problem is that when we're actually going to make detections, right? We will not have little points in this map. We're going to have ellipses in this map that are fairly narrow in chirp mass, but fairly broad in mass ratio, right? So that's going to make things tricky because we won't be able to measure parameters perfectly. So it depends in part on just how well we do in measuring the parameters, and therefore in the sensitivity of the detectors, because the ability to measure parameters depends very strongly on detector sensitivity. But roughly speaking, if we can see that there is no mass gap, again, quite easily with only a few detections, right? All it takes is you have one detection here, and already you're pretty confident that there is no evidence for a mass gap, at least not a large mass gap such as suggested by this plot. If you are in some of the sort of, let's say, the most pessimistic scenarios that I've looked at, where you know you try to shrink the mass gap as much as things would allow, and then you also consider a pretty poor ability to measure the source parameters, then in order to convince yourself that there really is a mass gap, might take as many as, let's say, a few tens to 100 detections. But certainly 100 detections should be sufficient.
So could I ask maybe the last question? You talked about chaos rearing its ugly head in the potential case that we have bumpy black holes. How significant is that for equal mass ratios? We talk only about the extreme mass ratios, and if it matters at all for equal or near equal mass ratios, is that a potential problem for template matching?
So I suspect that for nearly equal mass systems, you're actually not going to see convincing evidence of chaos because you're evolving so rapidly that essentially, you know, the only reason you can see this chaos here is that we are sticking almost in a geodesic, right? Because we have such a slow evolution over many, many orbits, right? And so we really get to see our geodesic sort of probing at an annulus in phase space. But if you're really evolving very quickly through the phase space anyway, because of the presence because the masses are comparable, and so the evolution is quite rapid, I think it's very unlikely that you'll see any kind of convincing evidence of chaos in that case. Also, there are sort of several different regimes, let's say, where chaos can be more or less apparent, and I didn't get a chance to discuss this in detail, but basically it seems that it would be very hard to get an equal mass system into the kinds of initial conditions where chaos is going to be prominent. So here, it's for people who are sort of familiar with ergodicity, there's something called the KAM theorem, Kolmogorov Arnold-Moser theorem, and it basically says that even in cases where you lose an isolating integral, you might still have nearly regular-looking behavior, in practice indistinguishable from non-chaotic behavior for some sets of initial conditions, and then for other sets of initial conditions, you might be exploring a fairly large annulus in phase space. For equal mass systems, I think it's going to be, at least our predictions are, that it's going to be hard to get into this regime where you would be likely to explore a significant annulus in phase space anyway.
Okay. So if there are additional questions, maybe you should come to lunch with us, since Ilya's appointment at 1. Let's thank Ilya again.
Thank you very much.